supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show, perlite, P-E-R-L-I-T-E. It is such an essential soil amendment, and it's misunderstood by many people, some of whom don't think that it's an organic amendment. We'll tell you all about perlite and exactly why it is organic after lots of your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Tana, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike.
How are you, Tana?
I'm great, thank you.
And where is Tana great?
I am in Daytona Beach, Florida.
Oh, well, how could you not be great, right?
For real.
All right, what can we do for Tana in Daytona Beach?
Well, I have been working on my vegetable garden, and I started compost like you suggested, but it's not ready yet, and I am kind of in a hurry to get some boxes going. And I did find at the big box store some Lambert soil. They have both garden soil and they have potting soil. So I was wondering, they're both organic, so I was just curious if either one would work for what I'm trying to do. I might be able to scrape up a little bit of compost, but for the most part, it would be just those soils in the box.
So you are making your own homemade compost, but you want to get gardening. Your season is radically different than ours. You may have to take a break in the hottest part of summer.
Yes.
What materials are you trying to make your own compost from?
In the past, I've just been using my dirt and some compost that I had been making all wrong with mostly vegetable scraps. But I did set up two compost bins with pallets, mm-hmm. and now I'm putting leaves in them and, okay. and just a little bit of the vegetable scraps.
Oh, good. Yeah, and in your climate, that'll become compost real fast. Are you shredding your leaves?
I don't have a shredder just yet, but we have mostly oak leaves, so my husband seemed to think that they would break down pretty quickly, but if not, I might be able to borrow a mulching mower from a friend.
That, yeah, he's got that one backwards. Oak leaves are actually very leathery and need to be shredded before they're going to break down, but running them over with a lawnmower would be great. Now, you're in Daytona Beach. You must have a lot of sand around.
We do.
I'm going to suggest that be one-third of
okay.
your mix. Now, the other thing you said is, quote, garden soil.
Right.
So it's just dirt.
No, actually, it had a peat moss and some other things in it. It didn't really have compost. On the bag, it suggested adding some compost to mm-hmm. that mixture.
Right. But isn't that the potting soil that would have the peat moss and everything like that?
They're very similar. I was surprised. It's almost as lightweight as the potting soil is, but it's a lot less money.
Huh.
Well, yeah, that's why I was curious about it.
Lightweight is good, Tana.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Now, do you have access to any compost in this garden center?
I probably could, but I'm guessing at the independent garden shops they're probably going to be really expensive, and I need kind of a lot
mm-hmm.
of it.
Well, here's what we're going to do. First, you're going to harvest some of your sand.
Okay.
Because that's going to be good drainage. You can make this one-third sand.
Okay.
And then make it one-third of, you know, if you say this garden soil has essentially the same ingredients and it feels as lightweight as the potting soil and it says it's organic,
mm-hmm.
you use that. Use okay. like a third of that. But then I'm going to suggest that especially on top, you spring for some compost right now.
Okay.
It sounds like, especially in your climate, if you're composting oak leaves and some kitchen scraps, maybe mix some coffee grounds in there to get things going pretty quickly,
mm-hmm.
that you'll be making reliable amounts of compost in the future. So for this one bed that you're anxious to get started, I would say spring for a couple of bags of good quality compost and mostly have the bottom of the frames, let's say they're a foot high, let's say the bottom 8 inches, that can be mostly sand and this organic soil.
Okay.
And then on top, put the compost.
Okay.
And that way you'll get the most bang for your buck out of the compost. And every time it rains, it'll be like a little dose of compost tea down to the base of your plants.
Excellent.
All right. Well, Tana, you're engaging in a great organic gardening adventure. Good luck to you.
Well, thank you very much, Mike. You've been very helpful to me.
All right. My pleasure. You take care.
You too. Bye-bye.
1-888-346-9499. Chris, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hey, Mike, how are you?
I'm doing good. Chris, how are you, sir?
I'm doing very well.
And where is Chris doing well?
Hendersonville, Tennessee.
Hendersonville, okay. Near Nashville?
Yep, about 20 minutes north.
Okay, what can we do for Chris in Tennessee?
Well, I put in 10 Camellia sinensis plants this last fall, and I was notified by the nursery a couple of weeks after I put them in that some of the plants in the shipment had a broad mite infestation. Shortly after that, I had noticed that some of the leaves on them were starting to turn brown in the back and fall off, and a couple of plants actually have succumbed, but now that it's gotten so cold here, they've sort of gone dormant. But I want to make sure that in the spring, I have a good organic solution to help get rid of them, because I would like to drink the tea from the plants once I'm able to start pulling leaves off of it this summer.
Where did you get the plants, Chris?
I ordered them from a nursery online.
Oh, okay. Do you know anyone in your area who can successfully grow this plant for their leaves to be brewed into tea?
I have not known of anybody in this area to do that, though researching the plants online, it seems that our growing zone seems to be accurate for the Camellia sinensis plant.
We used to get this question a lot back when I was the editor of Organic Gardening magazine. And our research back then, which was in the 90s, indicated that there was only one small area of the Carolinas that was a compatible growing area for this plant. I realize the books may say zone 7 to 10, but I think it may have needs other than that. Now, how many plants did you receive?
I had 10.
10. And right after you received them or as you received them, you got a call from the nursery that they might be infested?
Yeah, it was about a week to 2 weeks after.
Didn't they offer to replace the plants then?
They did, yeah. And they'll be replacing the plants when their spring shipping season comes up. But for the plants, though, it seems as though the mites, before the cold kind of set in here for the winter, it seemed like they maybe had spread to some of the other plants as well.
Yeah.
So that's where I want to just make sure that I've got something that, you know, I can put on them early in the spring when they start to show new growth to prevent them from spreading at all.
Now, you say this is a pest called the broad mite. Is there anything different?
That is what the nursery told me.
Yeah. Is there anything different about it other than the fact it sounds like it might be big from a spider mite or any of the other pernicious mites?
No, not that I know of.
There are predator mites you can buy, but they're best used in greenhouse enclosed situations. There are methods of control, for instance, growing organically as opposed to using chemical fertilizers. If you use chemical fertilizers, you'll never get rid of these things. Spraying the plants
right
down with sharp streams of water every morning, keeping the humidity high around them should be helpful.
Mm-hmm.
But the basic pesticidal answer, I think, would be horticultural oils. What is the Camellia tea plant like at this time of year? Is it woody? I realize these are probably very young plants, so they're probably still kind of greenish, right?
Yeah, yep. The stems on the plants look, yeah, like green. They don't look woody yet.
My first thought is to tear them up and burn them and start fresh next season. If you don't want to do that, and you know that replacement plants are on the way, so that these are test plants, so to speak, you can do anything you want with them. You can't lose. If you kill them, well, that's what I just said to do anyway, right? So,
sure, right.
So I would make a decision. Only you can make this decision. There are two kinds of horticultural oil. There's what's called dormant oil, which is a fairly heavy petroleum product that's used on the bark of fruit trees and other trees over winter to kill overwintering pests. It's very effective. There are also lighter horticultural oils that are vegetable oil-based and highly refined. And, you know, I'm going to suggest that rather than put dormant oil on these young plants, I would spray them with the refined plant-based horticultural oils, but I would not wait till springtime. I would not wait till they leaf out. I would soak them now to kill the overwintering pests. I don't know if these mites drop down into the soil to breed or anything like that, but you're going to have to do some research on that. If they do, cultivate the soil and put some suet feeders up to bring birds into the area to eat them. But the smart money says maybe pull them out, burn them, and wait for the replacement plants. And before you put the replacement plants in the ground, I would put them into pots, and I would put them in an isolated area, and I would grow them out in pots for the entire first season, making sure that they're non-infested, and then put them in their final spot in the ground in the fall.
Okay. Well, that sounds great. I will give the refined horticultural oil a shot and see what we can do.
All right. Good luck, sir. And, you know, call us back in 5 years if you wind up drinking your own tea.
Yeah, thank you. I will do that.
All right. Good luck.
Thanks so much. Bye.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and announce that I will return, triumphantly, I hope, to the Upper Dublin Public Library in Fort Washington, PA, for a fundraiser for the Friends of the Upper Dublin Library at 7 p.m. on Monday, February 17th. And on Saturday, February 22nd, I'll appear at Green Spring Gardens in Alexandria. But don't go looking for all the details at the events section of our website just yet, because we'll be right back with more of your fabulous phone calls and a little primer on perlite, how to use it and why it's organic. I'm Mike McGrath, and this is You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia.
Burpee supports You Bet Your Garden and offers over 70 new varieties for the 2014 growing season, including Steakhouse, a 3-pound-plus beefsteak tomato, and On Deck, a sweet corn you can grow in a container. These and more can be seen online at burpee.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show, perlite. Did you ever buy a tomato plant or a pepper plant and take it out of its pot and saw what you thought were little styrofoam balls? Well, that's an actual mined volcanic mineral that's essential for good plant health, especially if you have clay soil. We'll tell you all about perlite and why it's organic after lots more of your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Peter, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hey, thank you.
Well, thank you, Peter. How are you?
I'm very well. I'm calling from Little Rock, Arkansas.
Little Rock. Well, I mean, what a famous place. Bill Clinton's library is there, right?
Yes, yes, and it kind of looks like a trailer, but Other than that, it's very nice.
You can't feed me a straight line like that, Peter. I just got to bite my lip and the inside of my mouth and say, what can we do for you?
Well, I was actually calling on behalf of my brother. He has a few acres, a little ranchette, I guess, and he has for his bull and his chickens, he wanted to build a small pond, and so he hired some people with an excavator, and they came in, you know, dug up a pond that's about 10 meters across. You know, it's like a cartoon crater with a slight berm that goes all the way around it.
Right.
And the whole property is on a slight slope, but the pond's fine. They did fine, but he was very disappointed because the water is very, very murky. You know, it's totally brown. It's down, you know, looks like clay. And we were hoping to find maybe some bushes or trees or grasses that we could grow around that to help clear it up. Or if it's nothing to worry about at all and it won't be bad for the animals.
Well, any murkiness, any dirt should settle after a rain. And you're saying it sounds like when we get a rain that there may be water that flows into the pond?
Yes, right now we're getting runoff.
Right, and that is always going to be murky originally. But say, and I'm just going to grab a number out of the air, say 4 days later, the water in the pond should have clarified naturally as that sediment drops to the bottom.
Okay.
Is that happening, not happening, or it's so early it's hard to tell?
It's been well over a month, and it's still, you know, quite murky, but it's just that land is barren of any plants. So it could be that, you know, there's small runoff happening all the time, I guess.
Well, I'm going to make a couple of suggestions. Has he thought about anything of having like a fountain in the center to make sure that this doesn't turn into a mosquito breeding factory?
No, I don't think he has at all.
Okay, because you know that mosquitoes are going to breed in that still water.
Yes, they will love that.
So there's two options. One is an aerator. And these come in all shapes and sizes, and I believe there are a lot of them that simply float on top of the water and pump the water up and down very efficiently. And, of course, there's ones that are more exotic than that, but I think they would have had to have been built into the pond before it was refilled.
Gotcha.
But that's one option. Otherwise, make sure he treats the water with what's called BTI. I don't know if you've ever seen these little donut-shaped objects that are sold to keep mosquitoes out of still water.
I think I have seen those, actually.
Yeah,
I didn't know that's what they're called.
I've never been in a home store or hardware store in the summer and failed to see them. They're called mosquito dunks, and you can buy them in the little donut shape. Some are shaped like charcoal briquettes. Some are just granules. You definitely want to aerate that water and or treat it with BTI, or you guys are going to be given blood and not to the Red Cross. Long term, what I want you to do is go to our website. Go to youbetyourgarden.org. And there is a great article we did years ago under the letter R for rain garden. And what that tells you is the whole sequence of plants that you can use at the edge of this pond and even inside the edge of the pond that has water, and then different plants on the outside edge. And these will help filter the groundwater coming in so that it will naturally have less sediment. And all of this will help filter the water. Now, because you're in Little Rock, you also have to get local recommendations for the exact type of plants. You wouldn't be using the same plants as Michigan or Minnesota. But your local extension agent will have a list of rain garden plants, and the article on our website will tell you the terminology of what type of plants you want. So you're going to plant inside the pond, outside the pond, and every one of those plants is going to help keep that water from becoming muddy looking to begin with.
Thank you very, very much. I appreciate it.
But don't forget about those mosquitoes. You're in Arkansas. They're the size of house flies down there.
Yeah, we're no strangers to that.
All right, Peter,
thank
good
you
luck.
Thank you very, very much.
Take care, man. 1-888-346-9499. Heather, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi.
Hello, Heather. How are you?
I'm good. How are you today?
I am holding my own. Where is Heather good?
Well, I'm actually sitting in Oklahoma, but the farm I want to talk to you about is in southeastern Minnesota.
What are you doing in Oklahoma?
I'm living here now, but I purchased a small 35-acre farm in southeastern Minnesota, and I am planning on eventually moving there. And my hope is to grow alternative crops, as in not corn and soybeans.
Right.
And I'm looking at berries.
Right.
That I want to do on the property.
Okay.
I know that I can grow high bush cranberries because they're already growing in one part, so
there you
I want
go.
To expand that a little bit. And then I was thinking I was wanting to do currants and gooseberries, but as I investigated that more, I understand there's the white pine blister rust issue, and I've got a lot of pine trees on the place, and I don't want to start something that's going to cause a problem. So I was hoping you could help me find some varieties that are more resistant, because when I read the literature, I just can't really find that.
First of all, I'm going to recommend you buy a book by Lee Reich, R-E-I-C-H. Now, Lee is our small fruit specialist. He is absolutely head over heels in love with currants and gooseberries. And one of his earliest books, exact title is escaping me, but it's something about uncommon fruits for the everyday garden or something like that. And half the book is about currants and gooseberries.
Oh.
And so we've had Lee on the show, and we've used his material to reference different questions of the week that we have up at the Gardens Alive website. And the one on currants and gooseberries, Lee explained to me that this pine blister rust is a true phenomenon, that there is a rust disease that can transfer from white pines to certain currants, but for some reason it was overemphasized to the point of sheer hysteria, to the point where the plants were actually banned, I believe, in the United States, currants and gooseberries. Because as I'm talking to you, I'm looking at our question of the week on currants and gooseberries to make sure I got this right. And the disease only affects European black currants. You can grow red currants, you can grow white currants, you can grow pink currants, and you can grow a currant that is called the clove currant, which is a Native American plant as well. Now, the downside is the European black currant is the cold hardiest. So when you're talking about Minnesota, no offense, that might be something that you might want to plant. But you're absolutely right not to invite any problems, because I'm sure the place is lousy with white pine, right?
Oh, it's got a lot of white pine. It's got a lot of different trees. It's absolutely just gorgeous. And so I don't want to disturb the beauty of it while I'm trying to find something other than corn and soybeans for a marketable crop.
Whereby with fruits, you know, one thing you have to understand, one thing I've learned over time, with fruits, the work is in the harvest with these small fruits.
Mm-hmm.
They grow themselves. When you talk about blueberries, raspberries, did you say cranberries before?
Yeah, the American high bush cranberry.
Okay.
I've already got the European variation of that on the property. But that's the one that's not very tasty. And then I also found Nanking cherries that I want to continue to try.
You're Lee's kind of girl. You are going to fall in love with his books.
I love it already. It's
yeah,
awesome
he is. You too love the same kind of plants. And no cranberry is sweet on its own. Cranberry is one of those things that Lee almost calls not a fruit because you have to add sugar to it to make it edible. But they're a great call for them, a great use for them. My wife uses them in baking all the time. I would urge you to grow some raspberries. I would urge you to consider some high bush blueberries as well. They grow in the coldest climates. And again, the only trouble any of these plants have is in the harvesting. It takes a lot of time, and some of them have to be handled very carefully and sold very quickly. You know, they have a short shelf life, which is why you don't see currants and gooseberries in the store very often.
I'm going to start small with the establishment.
Excellent.
So that way I make sure I get it right. Start building my market is my plan. And then as it gets bigger, if I have to open up to a U-pick, then I can do that also.
Yes, especially with things like blueberries. That works out very well.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I insist you look up Lee Reich's books, R-E-I-C-H, especially his book on unusual fruits, because you're going to go nuts. There's also a couple of American small fruit organizations that you'll definitely want to study their websites. But I think it's a great idea. These are very high-value crops, tend to be pest and problem-free, and I think you're going to do great.
Well, thanks.
All right, Heather, good luck on your great adventure up in Minnesota. Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Take care. 1-888-346-9499. Virginia, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike. Thanks for having me on the show.
Well, thanks for being had, Virginia. Where are you?
I am in Bensalem, Pennsylvania.
Just outside of Philadelphia.
Yeah.
What can we do for Virginia and Bensalem?
So I started listening to your show because I want to start my own garden.
Good.
And I'm interested in doing some raised bed gardens.
Excellent.
But I'm not sure the location I've picked out in my backyard is suitable for them.
Okay.
And if it is, I've got some questions about actually building the beds themselves.
Very good. What kind of things are we talking about growing?
Broccoli, kale, lettuce,
mm-hmm.
and maybe even some squash.
Well, you realize the first three are cool weather crops.
Yes.
And the squash is a warm weather crop. Now, it does change everything because now I'm going to advise you to build raised bed frames that can accommodate a little bit of a hoop house action or row covers, and you can grow your greens and your broccoli all winter long.
Really?
Yeah, yeah. But you can't grow them in the summer, you realize.
Right.
Okay, so tell me your concerns about the site.
So it's in the northeast corner of our yard.
Of course.
It's an L-shaped section that runs along our fence and our shed, and each section of the L is about 8 feet long by 3 feet wide,
mm-hmm.
and it's covered with some small white landscaping stones that probably go down at least 3 to 4 inches.
So the stones are level with the rest of the yard?
They are, yes.
Okay. And we don't know how deep they go, and we don't want to find out.
No, they go down at least a couple of inches because we tried to dig some of them up, and we just kept seeing more of them.
Right, right, right. Now, does this area get enough sun?
It's sunny for a good bit in the afternoon.
Right.
But then also get some shade once the sun passes over and the shadows of the shed casts over.
Give me a number.
At most, I would say 4 to 5.
Oof. One of the issues with growing greens in low light levels is they have a tendency to take up excessive amounts of nitrates, which makes them less healthy than greens that got like 6 to 8 hours of sun. Does it get more sun in the winter time when the trees have lost their leaves, or is this all from buildings?
It does get more sun because there are trees, that do lose their leaves and allow more sun to come in.
Okay. Here's the deal we're going to strike up. 3 foot wide is perfect, and there's a fence behind it. What's the fence made out of?
PVC.
Boy, I don't like that either, kiddo. You know, PVC is polyvinyl chloride. I get yelled at by the chemists who listen, but that's kind of like solid bleach. All right, I don't want you growing anything right next to the fence. You know, just have 12 inches of mulch or something back there. And then you're going to frame it out. You're going to get nice, untreated wood or stones, maybe garden pavers, because if you decide you don't like it, afterwards, you can just break it down and reassemble it someplace else. You like that idea?
That is good. We might have some leftover garden paper.
Okay. But what we're going to do is we're going to frame it out, make it a foot high, and then fill on top, directly on top of the stones with 50-50 compost and screen black topsoil. And because you're going to be building these and you're going to be filling them with topsoil and compost, and you get those row covers, you get something to trap heat under there, you can start planting these things in February.
Oh, excellent. Now, is there any sort of barrier I need to put down between the topsoil compost mixture and the rocks, or do I just dump it right on top?
Is anything coming up through the rocks? You getting any weed issues?
We are on, I would say, about a foot end of on the end of each section of the L, is about a foot where there are some weeds that do grow up.
Okay. That's the area you want to cover with a single piece of cardboard. But other than that, if you can get by with just the compost and topsoil on top of the rocks, you'll have spectacular drainage from that level of rocks underneath.
Okay.
Okay, but make sure they're a foot high. That'll help prevent any weeds from coming up from that deep.
My husband will be actually building the bed because he is far more handy than I am.
And don't be afraid. Go to our website and scroll through the Garden Answers A to Z. There's lots on raised bed building, and there's lots on season extension as well, which suits you more even.
Perfect. Well, thank you so much for your help, and I look forward to eating all of my wonderful vegetables from my new garden.
All right. Good luck, Virginia. It's a great adventure.
All right. Thanks so much.
Take care. Well, it's time for me to take a little break and remind our listeners who are dragging out that cut Christmas tree that it can be put to very good use. My favorite is to prune off all the branches and use them to mulch around azaleas, rhododendrons, blueberries, other acid-loving plants, or just save them in case you have pansies outside and cover the pansies with the cut boughs before an ice and snowstorm. But if at the very least, make sure it goes to a recycling center, because a lot of communities now get these trees all together and use them to make artificial reefs to protect our shorelines, which is really cool. But don't you go repurposing your pine just yet, because we'll be right back with lots more of your fabulous phone calls and the real story behind those little white balls in your potting mix. I'm Mike McGrath, and this is You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia.
Burpee supports You Bet Your Garden and offers over 70 new varieties for the 2014 growing season, including Steakhouse, a 3-pound-plus beefsteak tomato, and On Deck, a sweet corn you can grow in a container. These and more can be seen online at burpee.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and we're in the stretch now, cats and kittens. In just a little bit, we'll talk about one of my favorite garden amendments, perlite, those little white things that you probably thought were styrofoam balls in your baby plants and potting mixes. It's a great way to get air into your soil, which may not sound important, but it really is. We'll tell you all about it after a couple more of your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Fernando, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thank you, Mike.
Well, thank you, Fernando. How are you, sir?
I'm doing fine, thank you.
And where is Fernando doing fine?
Lafayette, Louisiana.
Lafayette, we are here. All right. What can we do for Fernando in Louisiana?
Well, I always enjoy your show. The last show, you quoted Scotty from Star Trek, the original Star Trek series, when you said, you cannot bend the laws of physics. And I said, oh, man, he's quoting Star Trek. I got to call this guy. This is my problem, Mike. I have a bird of paradise that I planted in my yard about 6 or 7 years ago. They told me it was a white bird of paradise, but I thought it was going to be one of the red kind. It goes out in a fan fashion from the top and just kind of spreads out.
Right.
And he's been doing great. He kind of dies back in our mild winters and then grows back out. But he has never given flower. Somebody told me I have to wait until he has so many odd number of leaves, and somebody quoted 7 leaves. Well, he's gone up to 11, still no flower. Somebody else told me, oh, he's got to get to 6 or 7 feet. Well, this little plant gets up to about 10 or 11 feet and still no flower.
Really?
And I've, he's planted on the north side of the house, but still doesn't get a lot of cold weather, except for this winter that we had a couple of days of very cold weather. But other than that, the winters here tend to be mild.
Mm-hmm.
I've used fertilizers of different types. All the other plants that seem to sort of, you know, be nearby, they all flower. Nobody else is giving me any trouble. Except this little guy, you know, has never been able to flower. So is there such a thing as a non-flowering bird of paradise?
No, but they can be incredibly tenacious. How many years has it been in the ground?
6 or 7.
Okay, we might just be getting to that tincture of time point where it's getting ready to flower for you. Now, typically, even where you are, man, these are things that are grown in giant pots and hauled inside during the coldest months. I have 2 birds of paradise that I saved from a Philadelphia Flower Show exhibit I staged in 97. And they have bloomed for me since then only about 5 times. So they don't bloom all the time. They can be really sketchy. Now, you say it's on the north side. Does it get a ton of sun? These are tropical plants that like full sun.
He gets a good 10 to 12 hours of sun.
Oh, in the summertime, every day?
Yes, sir.
Honestly, I wish you had called before this brutal winter hit almost everybody in the United States. But starting at least next fall, I want you to pretend this is a fig tree. I want you to knock some stakes into the ground around this plant and wrap burlap around the stakes. And if you can get up high enough, throw some burlap over the top of the plant as well. Not plastic or tarps or anything like that. Just burlap. Because you do say you see some winter damage every year, right?
Yes, sir. We see, there's a little winter damage, especially on the uppermost leaves. Yes, sir.
Right, because those are the most exposed. So in the spring, which comes very early in Lafayette, remove all that burlap and cut away any leaves that are damaged and cut them off completely at the base. You know, it does need a certain amount of leaves, but your leaves are ginormous.
Yes, sir.
Right? What have you been feeding this?
Well, I've been using that one that you buy in a container, you mix with water, and you can spray with your hose.
These are tropical plants. One thing people don't realize, the tropics are very lush, but the soils are not very fertile. So you're spreading these concentrated chemical salts, which used to be put into artillery shells before we used them as fertilizer, maybe overpowering this plant, giving you a ginormous plant with no flowers. So no more feeding. In the spring, I want you to remove any severely damaged leaves. As you know, in the spring, it'll start sending up lots of new leaves.
True.
Right? So put some compost around the base. No more chemical fertilizer whatsoever. And keep your eye open for when the sprouts that form the flower heads come up, they look exactly like the leaves. But where the leaves unfurl at a certain point and open up, when you know you've got a flower spike is when it's been around that long and it hasn't unfurled. And then that is growing that bird's head inside. And leave it alone. And, you know, they tend not to bloom in the summertime. They tend to bloom in the off season. So I would expect if you're going to see flowers from a winter damaged plant, you'd see them in the fall of 2014. So no more chemical fertilizer. If you want to protect it this winter, fine. Definitely next winter. Put a little compost around the base in the spring. And no matter what else you do, remove any winter damaged leaves in the spring.
Perfect. Thank you kindly for your advice.
All right. Good luck, man.
Have a great day.
You too. 1-888-346-9499. David, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thank you, thank you, thank you. I hope things are nice where you are.
Well, it's winter here. It's about as good as it's going to get. Where are you, David?
I'm in Nashville, Tennessee, or south of Nashville.
So what do you got?
My question is, I have a 40-by-50-foot garden that I've built over the years. I'll tell you that last year I got, I understood the idea of don't till or do anything with your walkways. So I've got all that set out now, and I never have to walk on the plants. I had a real good success getting neighbors to give me leaves, and now I have 2,000 square feet of leaves that are shredded to powder, and they're now rotting happily since we had 7 inches of rain last week.
Huh, okay, very good. That's not the worst thing you could do. That
no, I'm really grinning, but I've got a, I think too much, and I've got a scientific question is it okay to plant the seeds in the compost, say 4 months from now?
I don't think they're going to compost. I think you will get some changeover at the base, but I think the top is still going to look like shredded leaves when planting time comes along. But this is not a terrible technique. Now, you say you're somehow like half pregnant, you don't have raised beds, but you're not walking on the soil somehow?
Correct.
How have you?
So I have the garden on a grid laid out a certain way with plenty of good walkways. So I will only, whatever you're going to tell me to do, I will only do it like on this row that's going to be beans.
Oh, okay. So.
And then 3 feet away at the next row of beans.
And but you're religiously opposed to building raised beds and making it like a super.
Well, no, I'm not. It would take take me a while, but I can head in that direction. I've kind of poo-pooed it because of the cost.
Well, it may or may not be costly. For instance, I bought a couple of timbers of Trex when I built my raised beds. Most of my raised beds I built with local stone that I had already hauled out to make my garden. And the precursor of framed raised beds is what's called the French intensive system, where you make these beds that are 4 feet wide and as long as you wish to make them, you know, as long as you're willing to walk around, but no wider than 4 feet because you're not going to step in them. And then you raise them up around the surrounding ground just 6 inches or a foot, but you don't frame them. You just use them as mounds.
Okay, that is definitely what I'm doing. And I can see doing what you're talking about. We have a lot of stone around here. It'd be beautiful to just do it gradually.
What you get from the stone, those beds will warm up faster in the spring and they'll stay warmer in the fall because they're absorbing heat during the day from the sun and they're radiating it back at night. I can't take credit for that. That's an old J.I. Rodale idea from the 1940s. So what are we planting again?
Well, say I'm going to have 4 or 5 kinds of beans.
Mm-hmm.
I'll have a bunch of squash. I'll have sweet peppers, and I know I'll just plant them in the ground and put the compost around them. And I'll have tomatoes.
In the raised bed areas or the, you know, whatever we want to call the mounds, that's for your peppers, tomatoes, squash. Rotate your tomatoes. You really don't have to worry about anything else.
Okay.
You know, the pole beans get so high, you can just take an area of flat ground and cultivate it.
Okay.
I would level it out. I would give it like 10 days, see if any weeds come up, slice those off with a hoe, and then put the beans in there along with whatever they're going to climb up. And if you're going to grow something like sweet corn, do a big dedicated area where you're perfectly welcome to till it up and then do the stale seed bed technique. Level it all out. Water it well, wait 2 weeks, use a sharp hoe to slice off any weeds that come up, and then put your corn in. Sweet corn,
okay.
Field corn, grows better in flat ground than in raised beds. I think that having the layer of leaves on top of the bed is a great idea. I think it's going to encourage earthworms to come live under there. I think it will prevent winter weeds. A lot of things do start up in the winter time. So move them out of the way to plant with crops like tomatoes and peppers and stuff. Move any leaf mulch right back on, right back next to the plant. That should really keep your weed woes down. And with the beans, you know, let them come up, let them get to be 6 inches to a foot high, and then move some of that stuff back around them. And you should be able to cobble together a combination of raised beds and flat ground. It should be very productive. But 4 feet wide for the raised beds, build a couple a year. You'll be really happy with them. Never till those. Just add the amendments to the top.
All righty. I'll send you some pictures.
All right. Good luck, David.
Thank you. Bye.
All right. As promised, it's time for the question of the week. Perlite, a great way to improve the drainage in your soil. And a little primer on what the word organic actually means. Alexis Landis, You Bet Your Garden producer, read us this week's intriguing question, s'il vous plaît.
Sure, Mike. We heard from Harry, who lives in Havertown, Pennsylvania, who writes, Dear Mr. McGrath, my wife is an avid listener of your program, planning her Saturdays so that she can be home when your show is on. She suggested that I contact you with my small concern that the perlite you often recommend isn't organic in any sense that I recognize as a chemist, or probably in any sense that non-scientists use organic, as it is a form of glass. Now, that doesn't take away from it being a useful component for gardening, as you have advised. The advice is still fine. I would just suggest adjusting your justification of it's organic. Oh, and rest assured that I am also a listener who enjoys your show. Keep up the good work. Mike, have you been recommending something that's not organic?
No, but we should thank Harry for bringing up an important point. In the world of technical chemistry, the word organic has a very different meaning than it does in the world of contemporary food and agriculture. But, you know, a lot of English words have multiple meanings, like bulb, which can mean an underground plant part, something that gives off light, or a squeezable thingy, like the back end of a turkey baster. Now, back in 1940, J.I. Rodale, the founder of Rodale Press and Organic Gardening Magazine, chose the word organic from a whole slew of words that the British were using to try and describe a form of agriculture that shunned the toxic chemical pesticides and fertilizers of the day. Things like arsenate of lead and ammonium nitrate, and later, famously, DDT. In the earliest and simplest uses of the word, organic meant anything that occurred naturally, like seaweed, manure, rock dust.
And perlite?
Yes, the misunderstood mineral. Harry is correct that perlite is a form of glass, specifically a volcanic glass that's mined and then heated in big ovens until it pops into a round white material that's used in seed starting and potting mixes to lighten the soil, allow more air around the roots of plants, and both help retain water and improve the drainage.
But most people think that those little white balls are some kind of styrofoam-type artificial substance.
Absolutely. That's what I thought they were my first couple of years while I was gardening.
Your bulb-forcing friend Art Walk has really raved about perlite on the show.
Yeah. One of Art's missions as an educator is to beat the importance of air in the soil into gardeners' heads, whether they're forcing bulbs in the ground or growing plants in garden beds. You may also recall that the great four-season farmer, Elliot Coleman, listed, quote, air in the soil as one of his three essential keys to healthy soil in the seaweed piece we just did a few shows back.
So how do you use perlite?
I buy a couple big bags of it every season and mix lots of it into my seed starting mixes. However much perlite they already contain, I add more. When I began to worry that the soil in some of my raised beds seemed to be getting a little heavy, I started mixing perlite into what's otherwise 20 years of compost. And I add a lot of perlite to my garlic planting beds in the fall to make sure the bulbs don't get waterlogged over the winter.
Wow, you make it sound as important as compost.
Well, remember when Elliot said that seaweed was the only input he'd buy if he didn't live right near a cold ocean where he could get a lot of it for free? Perlite is one of the very few things that I buy, and I use more of it every year. Air in the soil. It's just so important.
And you're certain it's technically organic because it's a mined mineral?
Yeah, like rock dust and seaweed, it's naturally occurring. It does need to be popped, but that only makes it more useful, not unnatural. And you don't have to believe me.
I don't?
Well, actually, you do have to believe me. I had that added into my last contract. But in this case, it's also official. In the early 1990s, the state of California did the hard work of beginning the cataloging of what would be allowed in what would come to be called certified organic agriculture. Then the NOSB, the National Organic Standards Board, was formed to codify the federal regulations that exist today.
Weren't you an early advisor to the NOSB?
Yeah, I was the editor of Organic Gardening magazine at the time, and we, Rodale, legally owned the organic trademark. But I didn't have to do much. And to specifically answer your question, all of the materials or inputs allowed in organic production are on what's called the, quote, OMRI list, the OMRI list, the Organic Materials Review Institute. You can access their website, type in the name of a product or material you're considering, and it'll give you a thumbs up or down on its organic nature.
And Perlite?
The thumb be up. Quote, status allowed in certified organic agriculture, a mined mineral. End quote. Well, that sure was some interesting information about the non-pearls of Perlite, now wasn't it? Luckily for you, the question of the week appears in print at the Gardens Alive website. To read it over in detail, just click the link for the question of the week at our website, youbetyourgarden.org. Gardens Alive supports the You Bet Your Garden question of the week. Yikes, my producer is threatening to replace my Perlite with popcorn if I don't get out of this studio. We must be out of time. But you can call us anytime at 1-888-346-9499 or send us your email, your tired, your poor, your wretched refuse, teeming towards our garden shore at garden@whyy.org.
Please, please tell us where you live. Please, please.
And visit our website, youbetyourgarden.org, where you'll find answers to all your garden questions, audio of this show, past shows, and our podcast. Elizabeth Perez Lunas, executive producer of audio content for WHYY. Ken Queter plays our theme song. Our engineer is Adam Stanishevsky. Rich Banowitz and Sarah Kazar, You Bet Your Garden's internet illuminators. Our social media director is Amanda McGrath. Check out her fine work every day at the You Bet Your Garden Facebook page. Our editor is Al Banks. Alexis Landis produces You Bet Your Garden for WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. I'm way full of air, Mike McGrath, and I'll see you next week. Even the cleanest of homes can sometimes be visited by the contemptible cockroach. I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden, we'll reveal the non-toxic ways to get rid of or prevent this odious invader. Plus your fabulous phone calls.